This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age podcast featuring the Sarcastic Four, episode 11, 1968, part 2.
Actually, I just walked in off the street. I had never met Stan before, and I had sold a comic book to Tower Comics. Those are the guys who published Thunder Agents. My friend Wally Wood got me an appointment with the publisher. He liked my work. And I got into a fight, a little altercation with the art director, and walked out of that place. And ultimately, that afternoon was one of the most action-packed because I had offers from three companies, and I finally sold that project to Paramount Pictures. And I had 15 minutes left, quarter to five, to get into trouble. So I took a cab over to Marvel, and I showed Stan my work, and he said, two famous words changed my career. Maybe changed a lot. He said, pick one. And what he meant was, pick any character, any comic book on the wall behind him. And I picked that guy, the man with the eye patch and the cigar. You know, all these heroes have masks and capes. I had to pick a guy with a cigar. And you know the rest is history.
Place to Be Nation Pop. Welcome back to the Marvel Age podcast. I, of course, am your host, Nick Duke, here once again to bring you along on our journey year by year through Marvel Comics and their entire publishing history. We have gotten all the way up to part two of 1968, and here to take you back to that magical year with me, as always, are the members of the Sarcastic Four, beginning with Tim Capel. Tim, how are you tonight?
Hey, a little worse for wear after getting pounded with 14 inches out here.
Now listen. I'm sure you could have been pounded with 4 inches, and it would have been just as good as getting pounded with 14 inches.
That's a controversial statement.
Well, I have it on good authority that it's possible.
Okay, well, suffice to say, I wasn't anticipating that, and we're going to try to make the best of it here, and I'm going to hang in there.
There you are. Journeying out to the West Coast, where there is no 14 inches, Mr. Todd Weber. Todd, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. I was about to make a snowblower joke, but it didn't work out. things are fine.
Or a snowball joke.
Snowball joke, sweatpants joke. We are watching me on my new and restored iPad Pro where I can read these comics. And it's refreshing to talk to you gentlemen where no Marvel luminaries have died recently. So there's that.
That is the first time in a while that we haven't had a death like right near a show. Good to hear the iPad Pro is back and in full working order. And finally, go ahead.
I may have just killed Joe Cena with that prediction.
Oh, shit.
Well, we'll tell the family that you're to blame, and eventually we can have a Joe Cena memorial something on the Place to Be Nation pop feed. But that's neither here nor there. Rounding out our Sarcastic Four, the other half of the Southern contingent on this show, Mr. Russell Sellers. Russell, how are you tonight?
Sitting around in my sweatpants and enjoying the greenhouse that is South Alabama.
Yeah. Funnily enough, I actually am wearing sweatpants for this show, so all kinds of nice mental images coming there. Of course, there are no guts and micro here to take you along on this journey through Marvel Comics publishing history. We have gotten all the way up to part two of 1968, so let's dive right in, guys. Let's pick up where we left off last time. You know, last time we covered some Avengers, some Thor, some Fantastic Four. Here we're going to jump in. You know, we're going to check in with a couple of familiar faces and also see the launching of a handful of new titles as well. So let's start it by checking in on Bruce Banner. Let's check in on the Hulk because we haven't really dealt with him in a while. In 1968, when we start the year, we see him co-starring in Tales to Astonish alongside the Submariner, but very quickly he will be restored as the lead of his very own title. So Tales to Astonish 101 is an anthology story, and then that story continues in the retitled Incredible Hulk 102. So we're going to cover both of those stories right here. This involves the Hulk being transported to Asgard by the trickster Loki, and Loki sets the Hulk on a rampage to distract Odin for his own nefarious purposes, which are never actually really clearly defined here other than just to cause trouble. So they're very clearly going with the God of Mischief approach, I guess, to Loki rather than him having any actual sort of scheme or endgame in mind. Ha, endgame. But in any event, I liked this a lot, not surprisingly. Far better than a lot of the Hulk stuff we've read to this point. Perhaps simply the Asgard connections. We get to see a lot of the Warriors 3 here, which is always appreciated for me, especially because now Stan is leaning into that classic Volstagg voice. And anytime we get Volstagg, it is outstanding. And also, Marie Severin here on art does a fantastic job in her renderings of Asgard. I was really, really impressed. No Jack Kirby, but she's damn fine in her own right when it comes to drawing the Realm Eternal. So with all that being said, I'll turn it over to Todd, since he's kind of a fellow Asgard aficionado. Todd, what did you make of these two issues of Hulk here and their kind of mini crossover with some of Thor's supporting characters?
Well, this is probably, with maybe the exception of the Hulk versus Silver Surfer last time, or 67 we had, this is the best Hulk we've seen. Mm-hmm. And really, really like the art. Severin's illustrative style, it's almost like book illustrations to me. And literally, these are comic book illustrations, but they're almost like plates from a novel. Just so realistic, almost. And I appreciate the art. And I love seeing kind of this Marvel formula. It's the Acts of Vengeance formula, I like to call it, where you take one character and who you'd expect him to fight, but you transport him and have him or her fight against the adversaries in another book. So you got Hulk against Loki, the Executioner, and the Enchantress here. And it was really fun. Notice that we have a new writer on board, Gary Friedrich. I can't say his name. Friedrich. And we think of him associated with books like Ghost Rider. But he's writing the Hulk now here. Everything's obviously overseen by Stan Lee. We also get in the full-length tale of Hulk number 102, which is pretty funny. It's just a renaming of this series, 102. We get an origin recap drawn by Severin. And so I really appreciated that, too, because mm-hmm. every number one issue, and we'll see this later in the second half of our show, should have that kind of a thing to fill in the reader on what they're reading, especially if you're joining the story kind of in the middle. So yeah, this is a big step up for Hulk. Great story. A lot of fun with the characters, and loved seeing how he interacted with the Asgardians, and seeing another artist's take on Asgard is really unique.
Absolutely. Tim, what were your thoughts here?
Along similar lines, I definitely enjoyed it. Thought it was the high point of what we've seen from the Hulk so far. I think it's kind of interesting how early Hulk comic appearances sort of mirror the same problem that the Marvel Cinematic Universe has had with this character, in that his solo outings are not so strong, but once you put him in kind of a team up or team setting, he really starts to shine. So this is sort of the Thor Ragnarok version of the Hulk, with apologies to you, Nick, But, you know, it just works a whole lot better when you're doing that fish out of water element to this character. And, yeah, that retelling of the origin was interesting to me. It's been about, 6 years since the Hulk's first appearance now. So I was kind of interested to see what details would they leave out. Would they embellish anything? Would we get any hard or soft retcons here? And for the most part, it does follow that story as we first encountered it, but de-emphasized things like, oh, he transforms at night and then turns back into Bruce Banner during the day. They obviously did not go so hard on the Cold War espionage weirdness of that first Hulk story. So already in some of these retellings, we're getting a little bit of, let's say, drift from the original stories, but in a way that I thought worked. I liked Gary Friedrich's script here. He's not bad at all as far as nailing the character voices. It's punchy. It moves along. Pretty concise, you know, not overly wordy. So I don't think we've seen anything from him up to this point, but nice first outing for this writer. And that Marie Severn art, it's almost unrecognizable from her work on Doctor Strange, which was very good in its own right, of course, but just takes it to another level here. And yeah, I'm right there with Todd and loving that art. So all in all, we bid farewell to Tales to Astonish, but that's okay because they seem to have figured out the Hulk now.
Yeah, if only we could have retconned Rick Jones out of existence, but sadly we could not take that drastic step so early in Marvel's continuity. Russell, what did you make of these? Were you as high on them as everybody else was?
Well, everybody's already pointed out that this story was written way better than most of the Hulk stories we've had up to this point. And as you and Todd pretty much said, it's because of the involvement of Asgard that these two issues are so entertaining. Hulk himself, to me, almost felt like a bit of a bit player in his own now new solo ongoing. And I felt like these two issues made a stronger case for a Warriors 3 ongoing than it did for a Hulk. Mm-hmm. But they do make some real strides here with the Hulk character that I'm glad you guys pointed out. The Hulk speak is starting to become a thing. He's no longer seemingly equal in intelligence to Bruce Banner. He's becoming more like the Hulk that we know and love from, yes, things like Thor Ragnarok, but, you know, just from other outside media as well. Like, he's, as I was reading this, he felt more like that classic Hulk character. But for me, the biggest draw for these issues was, of course, the all the Asgard stuff. I very much enjoyed Volstagg, who steals the show. I thought this was a pretty good use of Enchantress and Executioner. Made me want for an Asgard ongoing, more so than Hulk. And even though it was, I think, to this point, the best rendition of Hulk that we've seen up to this point, but if I were to have picked this up as trying it out for my pull list, I think the second that we get away from Asgard, I wouldn't continue on with the book.
All right. Yeah, I agree with you, but Hulk himself doesn't piss me off like he used to.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
He used to be an antagonist in his own book. Just like, why am I even liking you? Here we kind of relate to him a little bit better. There were a couple things I forgot to add. Loki changing the Hulk from Bruce Banner into the Hulk is kind of funny to me.
Mid-leap.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah. And on the last page of issue 102, we get one of the we have to come up with a no prize here because we have Fandral talking to Odin and stopping, but then Odin calling him Balder.
Oh.
And then Fandral saying that Hogan speaks the truth, but he says Fandral speaks the truth. So we have kind of a, I don't know if it's an editor thing or Friedrich messing around or what. We have some pretty egregious errors here, confusing errors.
Odin has not entered the Odin sleep in some time, and so he is he is displaying characteristics of Asgardian dementia is what's going on. He's mixing up names. He's losing his mind, essentially. That's what I'm going with anyway.
Asgardianheimer.
That's where I was going to go with that, too. But that's a good point, Todd, that the Hulk is just more likable and has more personality as a character than what we've seen before. He is more verbose than I think we're used to from Hulk, but he's doing that speaking in the third person thing, and he's not totally dumb, but he's not, Bruce Banner either. So it all is just, it just depends on where they're going to take the character and the types of stories he's going to appear in after this. It gets a big boost from this Asgard setting, certainly. But if they can keep that, again, that fish out of water type of storytelling with this character, I think it can work, but I guess we will find out as we track the Hulk in subsequent years.
Indeed, we will. Well, leaving the Hulk behind, let's move on to another character that got his own solo title in 1968, and that will be Mar-Vell, Captain Marvel, a.k.a., help me out here, Walt Lawson, was that his name, that I didn't even know existed? The alter ego?
Right.
Yeah, I'm trying to look that up right now. Yeah, Walt Lawson. Interesting. Anyway, yeah. So apparently something that was not on our list was Marvel Superheroes number 12, which was released in December of 1967. Did not make our 67 list. But that introduced the character of Captain Marvel. And then here in 1968, he is already receiving his own solo title. And, you know, for the purposes of this show, we read issues 1 and 3, not issues 1 through 3. We've discussed many times before our issues with the reading list. We will not go down that road once more. But here in these pages, we get to see – we are picked up really mid-story, a direct continuation from whatever was going on in Marvel Superheroes. And we have kind of Captain Marvel and his supporting cast seemingly already established. You've got him. You've got this old doctor guy that he's for some reason sharing a hotel room with that I've already forgotten the name of because I just didn't care. You've got Carol Danvers. You've got his Kree love. You've got this guy in the Kree Empire who is trying to set him up and engineer his downfall. And none of this really makes any sense to me. You've got him as a – so supposedly he's a Kree who has a Kree identity. He's Captain Marvel, and then he has an Earth identity as well. And it all just kind of runs together for me. Nothing interesting here really. I didn't think the art was very good. I didn't think the writing was very good. And of all the stuff on our list, this was a slog for me to get through. Did anybody else struggle with it as much as I did?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Tim. Tell me why.
Yeah. I didn't hate it. It's just I've read comics for a long, long time, and the mantra of every issue is somebody's first has really been hammered into my head. Well, apparently that doesn't apply to the first issue of Captain Marvel, despite presumably being many readers' first issue of Captain Marvel. It's just they don't really do anything to catch us up in the way that we would expect these comics to. It really throws us into the middle of the story that, I mean, it's not too difficult to piece together and just sort of catch yourself up. But I don't know, some kind of background might have been helpful for as much as that kind of thing has been rather obnoxious and intrusive in other series. Where is it here when we have not read the first appearances of this character? That was a little bit annoying to me, and maybe wouldn't have been as bad had we read those stories in the Marvel Superheroes anthology, which he had appeared in two prior issues of. But I don't know. This just... Even the art, which it's from Gene Colan, who mm-hmm. we've been pretty complimentary of, it's kind of a step down for him. I think just because, yeah, he's spread across a few different series at this point. He's also doing Daredevil by this time, I think. Mm-hmm. He's doing those backup stories that we'll get to in Silver Surfer. He's doing the Namor installments of Tales to Astonish. So, I mean, not exactly Jack Kirby, but you're asking a lot of Gene Colan here, and I think it suffers on these full-length stories and Captain Marvel. Pretty uninspired writing from Roy Thomas as well. I'm kind of, I don't know, something that struck me is, like, when does Roy Thomas really become, like, good, or at least just the Roy Thomas that I think of him as,
right?
Because what we've read of him so far has not set the world on fire by any means. But I just wonder, like, what's the appeal here? Like, why are we supposed to care about this protagonist? He's a Kree scientist, explorer, military guy. Like,
what is he?
Yeah. Supposed to be? Yeah. Why is he here? What does it matter? And
who is this old man he's sharing a hotel room with? I go back to that. Who is this? I that was the one part of the issue I could not or the story that I couldn't understand. Like, I put together everybody else's pieces in the story through context clues. But this old guy, I have no idea what the connection between these two characters is or why I'm supposed to care.
And why is he carrying around, like, this portable nuclear explosive that he has to – it's like a race against time deal to reset in issue three, which issue three was a little bit of an improvement on issue one, I thought.
I would agree, yeah. The Super Scroll is more visually interesting than Century 27 or whatever.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah,
this is just like a play for the trademark, right? There's not a lot beyond this.
I'd also like to say that even the costume design is not very good. Like this early green and white costume is kind of just not interesting. It's a rare misfire on the part of Marvel in terms of a costume creation. Most of them to this point have been pretty good. This one, however, is not. Russell, what were your thoughts here on our first introduction to Mar-Vell?
I had the similar complaints to what you had, especially with issue one. I thought that was – it's just so jarring whenever we get dropped into a story like this where this character has clearly been established somewhere else. We didn't get that on our reading list and should have if we were going to read this part of the story. And as I'm reading it, you're right. He's not an interesting character, but there are interesting things about him that I enjoyed, such as he's got an internal conflict because he could be ordered by the Kree to exterminate the human race or to start tearing them down. And in his own internal monologue, he is saying that even though he feels conflicted about it, he would carry out those orders if he were so told to do it. He plays the part. Everybody thinks him a superhero. But at any second, Mar-Vell could become a villain just as quickly. Mm-hmm. The whole superior officer like setting him up to – or I guess maybe not superior officer, but other Kree officer setting him up to be killed so he could take his woman. Yeah, we're not in real progressive territory yet for Marvel Comics.
However,
we still got a little ways to go.
However, we have to point out here –
Carol.
Yeah, Carol, exactly. If you want to talk about progressive.
Yeah, I was actually about to get to that point, that while they do that one terrible thing with this female character, Carol Danvers is immediately the most interesting character in this book. She is the character that I want to follow around because I feel like she's almost could serve as the POV character. She's the one who's investigating this mystery about Mar-Vell. She doesn't really like understand who this guy is. There's a lot going on, but she's not pursuing him out of any romantic interest. She's genuinely curious about what is happening around her. She's portrayed as intelligent, forward-thinking, and I very much appreciated that about the issue. Now, I read issue two, even though it wasn't on the list, because I hate these breakups that are happening on the list. So when one occurs, I just go ahead and read the missing issue. Issue 2 actually does a pretty good bit of character developing for Mar-Vell himself, though I still think the having to drink a breathing potion every so often is maybe one of the dumbest things that has ever been come up with for any character by as Stan Lee's creations go. And I also felt like by the end of issue 3, while it was – you're right – vast improvement, and this series does seem to be getting better as it goes along. I would not be inspired to put this on my pull list, and I'm hoping that maybe one day we'll see why this character is revered so much, why he is such a big deal, other than being the catalyst for the much more interesting Carol Danvers version. Mm-hmm. But as of right now, I would say that Captain Mar-Vell is a character who has been lionized in death for being completely useless in life.
We will certainly get there one day. Real quick before we move on to Todd's thoughts, I want to circle back around to Carol Danvers. One of the interesting things about her as we meet her here, is she the first like woman of authority we've seen in the Marvel Universe to this point? Like, she is introduced as a person. She's the director of this cape, director of security for this cape area. And instantly, like, there is no subservience about her. She is not there to play damsel in distress. She has authority, and she is a woman who is, you know, largely has agency in her own story. So this is right off the bat more progressive than any other female character that I can think of that we've encountered thus far.
Sure. And any of our reading to this point, that is absolutely the case. I mean, I don't know how it is in every single book that Marvel is publishing up to this point, but certainly for our purposes, Carol Danvers is leaps and bounds ahead of anything else that we've seen up to now. And it is a refreshing change of pace. I just wish that the book she was in was more interesting.
Yeah. It just instantly differentiates her from all the other women in the Marvel Universe we've encountered, and thus makes her more interesting because she is different. In any event, yes. Todd, your thoughts here on these early Captain Marvel offerings?
Not much to add, no. Carol Danvers is interesting, and I guess I didn't realize just how far back she went. I thought maybe she was more of a creation of the early 70s, just off the top of my head. She goes back all the way to the beginning here, and though she's been retconned many times, it's still interesting that she has an actual tie to the original Captain Marvel series. We have stuff I just don't care about. He's a spy here, right? He's who could eventually be called upon to attack, and he feels that burden. We have a pretty one-dimensional villain in Colonel Yon-Rogg, who is important for us at least to know because he's about to be brought into the MCU. So this character will exist later. I think Captain Marvel as a series gets at least more interesting when Gil Kane comes onto the book in about issue 17 or so. They redesign him. They make him more of a kind of a almost a tribute to Captain Marvel of Fawcett, where he has to switch places with Rick Jones. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. The costume gets improved. The art gets improved. Eventually, Jim Starlin does some great things with him, too, or so I've been told. So I'm looking forward to it. I have read the death. Spoiler alert. The death of Captain Marvel. I guess Russell spoiled that. Yes. Graphic novel. And that was fine. It was just one of those things that, okay, I knew he had been dead for some time. I picked it up, and he dies of cancer. There it is. But yeah, this is probably a character that I just am not really given a reason to care about. And I can wonder if they did a reprint of that original story in issue one, but I don't know. I don't know if they were able to do that, or they just assumed that every Marvel reader read all of the books. But I forgot that Marvel Superheroes Anthology was even a thing. You know, what other kind of stories were in that?
Yeah.
There's Inhumans.
That's why it's not on the list.
Yeah, there's some Inhumans in there. Guardians of the Galaxy debuted in that, too.
And I think that's right. Actually on our list in the coming years.
That's a 69er, I think.
Yeah. I don't recall which it is.
Hey-o.
There is something, maybe there is something to the idea that Captain Marvel is an alien. He's not immediately bought in on the whole, like, nobility of the human race and, oh, they're so special and I am now a part of them. Like, he's very loyal to his own people, and it's gradually he seems to get drawn into this status of being a protector or a guardian to his now, I guess, adopted planet. But we're not seeing that right away, and that could be potentially a decent hook. It's just we're not there yet, and it's just such a failing of a first issue to not introduce your character. I'm sorry. Even if he first appeared somewhere else, you have an issue one on your cover. So I don't care if it's 1968. That's pretty bad.
Yeah, we should be getting like the origin of Captain Marvel and then maybe like slip towards this story that they're telling. But you're right, Tim. Whenever we're dropped into this, you are given absolutely no reason to care about this character whatsoever. And to the point about his costume, yeah. Yep, that is one of the biggest pieces of garbage I've ever seen. it immediately turned me off of reading the book.
Yeah, like
according to Wikipedia, if I may Chris Cole this for a second, usually credited as a
making Marvel Age great again.
Yes. Gene Colan had no involvement with Captain Marvel's conception, and in fact has voiced an intense dislike for the character, and especially his original white and green costume. It was awful, just as an imitation of any of the other costume characters I'd ever done. So Colan didn't actually design this character. Costume. I'm going to guess it was somebody else from the bullpen, Marie Severin or John Romita, and they just said, "Here you go, draw this, Gene."
Well, I think we can now say that Gene Colan was absolutely one of the smartest guys who ever worked at Marvel.
Oh God, I just made the mistake of looking ahead, and I hope we don't have very much Captain Marvel on our list going forward. Also, according to Wikipedia, Rick Jones and Captain Marvel will eventually share molecules, allowing only one to exist in the real world.
I alluded to such.
Oh,
yes.
In any event,
they try and try to make Rick Jones a thing, but stop trying to make Fetch happen. It's not going to happen.
The best usage of Rick Jones I've ever read was the fake Rick Jones in the early pages of Alias. If you guys remember that, just outstanding. Oh man, yeah. You said Ronan the Accuser. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, we get a lot of the Kree. We get allusions to the Supreme Intelligence, though we don't see it. The Ronan the Accuser is there. He's probably, and then some of the Blue Kree, but we also have a lot of the Caucasian Kree.
The Blue Kree.
I don't know.
I believe apartheid still had them separated at this point. I'm not sure.
If nothing else, these first issues of Captain Marvel really do seem to like plant a lot of seeds for the Kree Skrull War that we're going to see later.
Right, that's true. And very formulaic, but still, you know, it's a lot of data dumps. And boy, Medic Una, is that her name? Una.
Yeah.
She's Una. Kind of a dull character.
Yes, she is. She's much less interesting than the other female character in the book, Carol Danvers. But in any event, Tim actually brought up, you know, the issues about not really establishing the character and who he is here in issue one. So it's kind of an interesting segue into our next topic, which is Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., getting his own solo series. And here, much like in Captain Marvel, as we know, we had followed Nick Fury in the pages of, what was it, Strange Tales, I believe, before he got his own solo title. Under the direction of Jim Steranko. Steranko, of course, being given both writing and artistry duties on these pages, on the solo series. And much like Captain Marvel, we are expected to just kind of have knowledge of Nick Fury and his current modern-day status quo coming in. And I suppose because we had read the other stuff, it didn't bother me nearly as much. It wasn't nearly as jarring. But also, I think I would be willing to accept damn near anything that's drawn in this early Steranko style. It is outstanding to behold. It is instantly different than just about anything else on the stands for Marvel at this time. And when you give him the ability to script the issues and write the plots too, we get the rare, you know, dialogue-less panel here. We start to see some of that decompression a little bit. Not every panel is packed with information. There's an almost silent sex scene in one of these first three issues we read. Not a sex scene. I guess a foreplay scene would be more apt description. But, I was kind of blown away by this just because of how different it read than anything else I think we've read for this project to this point. Even more so than even the Steranko stuff we read in Strange Tales. It really feels like Steranko being allowed to pretty much do whatever he wants within a certain, you know, within reason anyway. It pains me to say it given that it's Nick Fury. I love these three issues. I thought they were instantly the best Nick Fury stuff we've read, and the art in particular puts it up there, you know, in terms of art with anything else we've seen to this point. Todd, I'll throw it over to you because you're more of an art guy than I think the rest of us are. Even talk to us a little about the Steranko, the early offerings from him here on this Nick Fury solo title.
All you need to do is get that first issue, open up to that splash page, and then you have four dialogue-less pages where the art just tells a story. Beautifully drawn art from different points of view. Amazing forced perspective. Amazing foreshortening. Just beautiful, realistic, and scientific art. The way he would do the tech was great and a little different than Kirby. who is known for his tech art. Just wow. This is timeless stuff, and every real comic fan should own this. And I'm going to try to find a collection of this. I've read these here and there back in the day, but looking at them on tablet form here on Marvel U, these are just some of the best. These are probably the best run of comics. These four issues that are all on MU, and I went ahead and read number 5, even though it's from 69. They hold up. They're easy to follow as far as even if you don't know who Nick Fury is. The Scorpio is a great villain.
Yes.
Just, oh my God, this is great stuff. And to imagine that this is 1968, this is so far ahead of anything you could imagine coming out in 1968. This is the moon landing of comics to me.
Right.
It's so good. And Stronko deserves his legend. But boy, I wish there was more of this. This series ends at least on MU at number 5, and I'm kind of curious as to where he went. You know, what happened? What's the story? But that's better to burn out than to fade away, I suppose.
Absolutely. Russell, what were your thoughts here on this? These early Nick Fury issues?
I'm right there with you guys. I loved this.
Yeah,
awesome. I loved every issue of this that we read. Jim Steranko, I mean, he was well known. The legend of Steranko on these Nick Fury issues is well known. I've seen it chronicled in documentary form before, but I've never actually read the issues myself. And now, having read these first three issues, regardless of era, this is pull list material. This is instantly something I want to read every single month. They have really turned Nick Fury around. And like you said before, how we had said that in, you know, Captain Marvel's case, we didn't get so much of an introduction to the character in his first issue. And we kind of sort of don't with Nick Fury either. But I still felt like just this opening page of, like, dialogue-free action gives me a much more intriguing hook to want to see what's happening with this character. And once there is dialogue in the page and we're starting to learn more about it, it's like, okay, well, he's a super spy. That's all I really need to know. And we go forward from there. And as Todd said, the Steranko art is just brilliant. This guy is the next level for Marvel. He has to be. He comes in and in pretty much just a single issue changes the comics game. It can't be the same after this. And speaking of that decompressed story that Steranko introduces, I don't know if you guys noticed this, but I started seeing it becoming a thing in other books and some of the other books that we read, that other artists, other writers are starting to take a bit of a step back, and we're not getting the wall of text so much in these other books like we used to. And I think that this Nick Fury book plays a huge role in that. Steranko is just one of the all-time greats. And in my mind, this is, like Todd said, a book that everyone should own. And if I can find a copy of Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. number 1 somewhere, I think I'm willing to invest the money in owning a copy of this physically, because it is absolutely tremendous work.
You know what's crazy is Jim Steranko is undoubtedly a legend in the comics industry. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think all of us are aware of Jim Steranko. I'm looking at Wikipedia right now. His bibliography, if this is accurate, this is the entirety of his Marvel work. Captain America 110 to 111, Captain America 113, these three issues of Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., plus issue 5, Our Love Story number 5, the aforementioned Strange Tales work, Tower of Shadows number 1, X-Men 50 to 51, and a cover for Foom, the Marvel fanzine. That's it. That is the entirety of his Marvel work, which is incredible considering how notable and revered he is in the industry. Tim, you haven't had a chance to weigh in here. Take it away, sir.
Yeah, we are 4 for 4 on this. How do you really do justice to the visuals in these comics on what is an audio medium? I guess the way I would put it is, it feels like something that doesn't belong in comic books. Like, what he's doing is so pushing the limits of the medium. It is just hugely ambitious. I almost think, and maybe this is going to sound like blasphemy, but try to work with me here. It's like the 1968 of a Grant Morrison comic, where, I mean, artistically, let's say, where there's big ideas, there's these big, in terms of just the writing, because let's take nothing away from the fact that he's writing this stuff as well. You've got like big emotional character plays, and you've got side characters that are given like a lot of color, really. Mm-hmm. And some of that stuff, it doesn't always land or feel totally earned, but it's impossible not to respect that effort because it is just so differentiated from literally everything else that is being published at the time. And I mean, I wonder, did 1968 comics readers, did they think this stuff was pretentious? I don't know. Pretension just seems like something that is so rooted in like our contemporary readings and expectations, and just over enough years we get the context and the perspective to appreciate just how wildly inventive what he was doing was. It's just unreal to me. And you know, we haven't talked too much about the content of these stories. Todd mentioned that in that first issue, Scorpio, who, very cool design, cool kind of freaky character who we're going to see more of. The second issue has a character called Centurius, who, I mean, he's a rare black guy in 60s comics. You know, how many black characters have we seen up to this point? And I know that sounds like faint praise, but it's sort of the fact that it isn't made a big deal is kind of a big deal. Third issue, I wasn't entirely feeling that sort of Dark Shadows meets Hound of the Baskervilles storytelling mashup he was doing. But again, it's
in that one in particular, if you look through it artistically, he is doing really different things in terms of like the lettering and the layouts and the color palette that's being used. Like, that might be the most out there, you know, artistically of the three issues, even though narratively I'll agree with you, it may not have been the most engaging one.
Did anybody else want to see Jim Steranko's take on Scooby-Doo after that?
I mean, a little bit, yeah. Like, towards the end, it sort of stopped being a comic almost, where it's just...
It's a Scooby-Doo episode.
Yeah. It's like a whole lot of it's like exposition, here's what happened, but you're not even really reading so much as just gushing over the pages. Right. And it's the type of thing that would bother me if it was just workman-like art, but... Here, I'm like, yeah, I don't care. It's cool. So, yeah. Wow. Yeah, I just think that, I don't know, maybe Marvel mismanaged him. They just, you just don't know what to do with a talent like that.
Right. Did he go into commercial art or something after this? Or what?
I don't know.
He actually stayed in the industry.
Worked for the CIA. What?
Yeah, really. I think he kept working in the industry, but not doing interior art. He did that, how to draw this, like the Steranko Guide to Comics or whatever. Just sort of things off in the margins. And you look at it and you're like, how is that how a guy like this ends up? But yeah, it's just one of those things where he was maybe just too talented and was not that old at the time. I think he was still in his early 20s.
Yeah, and he would later go on to do concept art for films. He did concept art for both Raiders of the Lost Ark and Bram Stoker's Dracula. So tons of just variety in the man's career. There was one in particular that Greg and I were talking about a while back that we just could not believe. What is it? He wrote an autobiography called, yes, Steranko, Graphic Prince of Darkness by Jim Steranko, which was published in 1997. Wow. And I must read this now. It sounds incredible.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Has there been an omnibus of his comics work? I feel like there ought to be.
Yeah, I mean, looking at it now, I didn't know his Marvel work was that. Like, he's got a ton of cover work listed on his bibliography, but, like, yeah, in terms of interiors and stuff that he actually had a hand in writing, there's really not that much. You could easily publish that in one volume. Oh, yeah. I mean, if you had the wherewithal. But with all that being said, I think we kind of hit the midpoint of our reading list, so there's no better time than right now to take a break.
I got a quick point.
Yeah,
I'm
go
sorry.
Ahead. No problem.
Not listed on MU is Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. or Nick Fury Agent 4, mm-hmm, which is kind of the iconic psychedelic cover. I mean, a lot of these are psychedelic covers.
Right.
But it's black and white with the spirals. And if you haven't seen that cover, Google it. Nick Fury Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. number 4. That's the one most people think of when you think of a classic Steranko Nick Fury cover. So,
right, I don't.
But that's not on MU at this point.
I don't think he did interiors for that. Is the reason that it's not listed on his bibliography or is on MU? I don't know. At least according to the bibliography I was just looking at, it listed
that would make sense
1 through 3 and 5 in terms of his interiors, while he did the covers for 1 through 7. And apparently, he leaves the book in terms of writing and interiors after issue 5 for whatever reason, and then does the covers for 6 and 7 before departing the book entirely. So no clue what happened there, but very interesting nonetheless.
I hope we cover those Captain America issues. Those are so good.
Those are indeed on our reading list for 1969, to tell tales out of school. But in any event, let's go ahead and take a break right here. Stick with us through the break. When we come back, we're going to cover another debuting title in 1968, that being Silver Surfer in his own solo series. And we're also going to check back in with Peter Parker in a little bit of a longer format as we take a look at the 5th Amazing Spider-Man annual. Stay with us. We will be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
PlaySuite Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaySuiteNation.com, and we now offer them to you on 2 great feeds. On the PlaySuite Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTB in Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaySuiteNation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaySuiteNation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaySuiteNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, Place to Be Nation Pop listeners, to the Marvel Age podcast. We're just going to pick right back up where we left off before the break. and dive right into the pages of Silver Surfer. The Silver Surfer, as we all know, Norrin Rad, we had gotten an introduction to him in Fantastic Four a couple of years back. And notably, we brought up many times over the course of this show and both here and on Marvel Age Masterclass that the Silver Surfer was one of Stan Lee's favorite, if not his absolute favorite creation that he ever came up with. And so it stands to reason that at some point he was going to get a solo series, and that finally comes along here in 1968. Interestingly enough, the first three issues of this title, which are on our reading list, are all double-length issues. I think clocking in on Marvel Unlimited at about 41 pages each. That's without the ads and any back covers or letters pages that may have been included. So 41 pages of story here from Stan and John Buscema. And I got to be honest, guys, the Surfer was something I always enjoyed as a bit player in the pages of Fantastic Four, that one Hulk story that we read. I was not anticipating enjoying this particular story, these three issues, as much as we wound up doing. And really, this drives home a point that I think has been said about Stan and about comics, not just since his death, but even prior to it. You know, with all the stuff about comics trying to be a bit more diverse and relevant and having something to say in recent years, and some people pushing back against that and claiming they just want escapist entertainment. Look no further than Silver Surfer 1 through 3 for an example of a comic story going all the way back to 1968 that clearly has something to say about the world it is being released into. For that reason, I feel like it's probably Stan's most, you know, relevant, if that makes sense, creation. And it's probably some of his most introspective writing. I really dug this. All of Stan's plots and dialogue to this point have kind of just been okay. It's more for the concept than it is anything else. But here, I was really hooked into the character development of everything. Blown away by how much I enjoyed these three Silver Surfer issues. Todd, as a longtime reader of Marvel Comics, tell us about these Silver Surfer issues and how impactful they really were.
This is kind of something that used to be a blind spot for me, and I went and I read these, which are all extra length, mm-hmm. bi-monthly issues, mind you. So this was every other month. Buscema was doing Avengers at this time. The inker was doing Fantastic Four. Stan Lee was editing the entirety of Marvel Comics. And you had something that Stan obviously loved, poured his heart into, did this fantastic issue number one. It looks to me like it might have Kirby breakdowns. I'm not 100% sure. The art looks a little different than the rest of what you'd see from Buscema the rest of the way. Plus, he's drawing a lot of recapping Kirby pages. But this is really dynamic storytelling about a character who came to Earth and fell in love with the people and the opportunity of it so much that he, you know, he's willing to give up ever seeing his lady love again. He saved his own planet by serving Galactus, and now he's betrayed Galactus and for Earth. And now he's like, why am I even doing this? Earth sucks. People are jerks. But it was nice where they Stan interspersed, you know, his origin coming up in 2 and 3. Issue one was had his origin as well, plus all of his recap appearances in, you know, what he had done with Fantastic Four and Doctor Doom. And you'd seen all his backup stories and his fight with the Hulk. What an interesting story that I kind of took for granted. I just thought Silver Surfer was pretty basic back then. You know, he was a one-dimensional character. But this is much better than I ever anticipated. To me, before this, the only... I mean, besides some of the Starlin, Ron Lim, that era, I'd read some Silver Surfer, a one-shot from, I believe, 1982, the one that the Joe Satriani album took all its art from, and that was drawn by John Byrne, written by Stan Lee, but it's basically a recap of his origin with a little bit of a new story. This is a better comic to me, honestly. And these first three issues give you enough to see why Stan loved him. I'm kind of surprised he didn't take off a little bit more, you know, become more of a well-known pop culture icon. I mean, people know who he was, but he wasn't a Spider-Man by any means. And I'm kind of like, well, wonder why. These are great stories.
Absolutely. Russell, your thoughts here on these early Silver Surfer issues?
I was a huge fan of this. I was at first a little miffed that suddenly we were getting double-sized issues because I was like you guys, I wasn't expecting a lot from Silver Surfer. All the stuff we'd seen on him up to this point, he was good in his role, but I didn't think that this was a character who could necessarily carry his own ongoing title. Oh, how wrong I was. This is right on up there, I think, with the stuff that we read in Nick Fury. This grabbed me from the jump, loved every bit of the character development that's happening here. It's, as you pointed out, Nick, maybe the most introspective that Stan ever got in all of his writing. And he does it through the lens of this character who was once mortal and now has these godlike supreme abilities. And all he wants to do is make this place where he is now trapped into a better world. But he's surrounded by, as he points out himself, people who have only ever known fear and violence on like a level that he's himself has only ever been able to imagine, because he comes from a world that wanted for absolutely nothing. Everyone was living in essentially a paradise, and now he's, you know, kind of feeling that longing, that woe that comes along with no longer having that, even though the whole time he was living on his home planet, all he wanted was adventure and excitement to get away. And now here's a man who's been given all this power, all this like cosmic ability, and he's basically had everything that he took for granted taken away from him, and it's causing him his own, you know, his own issues. But it's one of those books that comes out of nowhere and really hooks you into this character, and gives you so much more of a reason to care about him, something that I totally didn't expect. So I am fully on board for way more Silver Surfer. Bring more of this on, please.
Absolutely. Tim, your thoughts here on these first three Silver Surfer issues?
Yeah, similarly, I did not anticipate liking this as much as I would. Something I have wanted to comment on is, you know, in the days since Stan Lee's passing, there's been a lot of debate as to the extent of his contributions in a true creative and collaborative capacity. That's a lot of alliteration right there that I feel like I was channeling Stan a little bit. There's people who say Stan Lee, he never actually created anything himself. He just put word balloons and other people's creations and took the credit. And I just think that's way too extreme of an overcorrection. And like with most arguments of that nature, the truth lies, boring as it sounds, somewhere in the middle. But you cannot look at this solo Silver Surfer series, here it is again, and just deny what a powerhouse writer Stan could be. I mean, this is a really great look at Stan, the creator, not just the scripter or the huckster or, you know, the company man that his detractors try to limit him to. We see him putting a very personal stamp on this series, and the Silver Surfer, the character, just stands out as such a true passion project for him. And I mean, I don't mean to downplay the input of John Buscema as the artist here, but this is just so Stan Lee through and through to me, and just is very impressive. Like, he could write his ass off when he wanted to, you know, and I am just so grateful that we got some exposure to that Stan Lee. He leans hard into that whole feared and hated by world they're sworn to protect. You know, we more classically associate that with the X-Men, but it's pervasive throughout a lot of, just as a theme, throughout a lot of Stan Lee writing. And we see it go into really overdrive here in these stories. And the way that some of the interactions that the Silver Surfer has with humanity are characterized, like, that's kind of more misanthropic than I think Stan Lee is being.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of impressed me on that level that he could really go there. We don't see him doing the little, like, you know, the cutaway stuff where he's like, well, true believers, if you thought that this was going to happen, but it's like, he doesn't do any of that stuff. He's being very, very sincere in these stories. And I just think they're all the better for it. So it kind of, I don't want to say it totally blew me away, but for what I was expecting going into this, I was like, wow, this is really very impressive.
Yeah, I'd say that you're right, Tim. He played it as straight as we've ever seen him play any of his work up to this point. He took this work so completely seriously, and now it really does become clear to me that this may really have been Stan's favorite character to write.
Mm-hmm. It shows. It really does.
Especially just because, like we said, the voice comes across so much differently here for this particular character in this particular series than it does for anything else we've seen written by Stan to this point. Anybody else got anything else they want to bring up on Silver Surfer before we move along?
Sure.
Yes.
A return to the 1- and 2-part stories in the same issue.
Oh, yeah. Good call.
Things that we'd see in early issues of Marvel. Stan would do that, where he'd have kind of a breaking point and intermission. Again, just the art seems to vary issue to issue. I mean, Buscema is one of Marvel's best, and there seems to be some stylistic differences issue to issue. Issue 3 especially, you see some just amazing panels, particularly the first one of Mephisto. And God, Mephisto is a great villain, great character. He's Satan. He's the devil in a comic book.
He's Nick Duke in a comic book.
Yes.
Yeah. He's Slytherin.
Nick Fisto.
I have not fistoed anyone, for your knowledge, for the record.
That we know of.
No, did anybody else think that was Mexican Galactus?
I was going to say Spanish Galactus, but okay.
El Bandito Galactus.
But there again, the use of Galactus here was so good. Like, it was a reminder of how good that character is, because I felt like it feels like it's been a minute since we've really gotten a reminder of how awesome he is. We got a little bit of him in the first part of 68 and Fantastic Four 77, but I don't know, seeing him here again, it kind of makes me long to see the character again, and I think that's coming up later.
Some major shit goes down in these first 3 issues. Like, that first issue, we get the complete origin of the Silver Surfer presented very cinematically, I thought. A lot more Galactus, which is certainly appreciated. Second issue, we get the brutal and warmongering Badoon race making their first appearance.
Ooh la la.
Yeah. Ooh la la.
X-Men Badoon. Joke.
No, I got it. Why do I always,
you're the same guy.
You know, they're more commonly associated with the Guardians of the Galaxy, but I don't think I knew that they actually debuted in Silver Surfer comics, so that's pretty neat to see. Confirmation as well that Shala Ball is not only still very much alive, but still pining for Norrin Rad. That was something that I'm not sure if it was deliberate or not, but I got the sense coming out of that first issue that after his transformation, the Silver Surfer had been at this for a long time, being the Herald of Galactus, like potentially for centuries, and that whatever his life was on Xin-La, that all those people would have been long dead. But it turns out, no, it's actually not been all that long. And these people still remember him. And so, yeah, that was a pretty cool reveal. And then that Mephisto issue in issue 3, holy crap. It's like a epic gothic fantasy looks so cool, and that Silver Surfer Mephisto dichotomy, low-key, that might be my favorite in all of comics. I don't know if I want to go that far, but it's just so good. Wow.
Man, high praise here from the panel for Silver Surfer. Anything else we want to touch on before we move on to the last thing we covered on our reading list?
Stan was right, man. Silver Surfer's great.
Yeah, this was awesome. Mm-hmm. Silver Surfer in this incarnation is fantastic. Nothing else really to say about it. Moving on, let's check back in. Finally, the last thing on our reading list for 1968. Let's check back in on Peter Parker. While we don't have any of the normal issues, the regular issues of his solo series on here, we do have annual number 5 that would see the big reveal of what exactly happened to Peter's parents, what their backstory was, why they weren't around when he was a kid. And I have to say, I enjoyed this. You know, I am usually someone who is very hesitant anytime a story directly involves Peter's parents, because I think most writers, especially in the modern age, have just mishandled that and bungled it or find it far more interesting than I do. But here, this original telling of it, I got to say, is pretty solid. Involving the Red Skull in a way I didn't see coming. I enjoyed it. Didn't love it, but I enjoyed it. Russell, you're the other big Spider-Man fan here on the podcast. I'll let you lead off here with your thoughts on Amazing Spider-Man Annual number 5.
First, I want to point out the positives that I liked about this. This is another one of those issues, like we pointed out with Nick Fury, having kind of a decompressed approach to storytelling. It lets the artwork really handle a lot of the heavy lifting. There's not so much of a big wall of text that's going to just come along and hit you in the face. So as an issue that is actually the longest single issue that we read of any of our books, it clocks in around 48 pages, I found it to be one of the fastest reads because the artwork is allowed to tell the story in a way that a lot of other Spider-Man issues has not been up to this point. And, of course, the continued voice for Peter Parker here is done incredibly well. And like you, I found this take on Peter's parents to be far more intriguing. The use of Red Skull was good. But this issue also introduces one of the elements to Spider-Man that I despise the most. And that is that his parents were super spies.
Right.
It's something that I find just absolutely... It's an egregious error on Stan's part to make this part of Peter's background, because while Stan does this story very well and kind of closes the book on it, honestly, at the end of the story, though it doesn't really go into detail about just exactly how Peter is going to clear his father's name without also exposing his own identity, it does at least leave you with a feeling of, okay, glad we got that sorted out, and we can totally move on. Unfortunately, other writers and artists would come back to this well and dip into it one too many times, to the point where they would ultimately at some point be involved in experiments or other scientific goings-ons that would invariably lead to their son becoming a superhero. And to me, that kind of takes away from the specialness of what makes Peter Parker and Spider-Man himself so important in the larger Marvel pantheon. It's just a little too much addition, you know, and retconning, if you will, of a character's history. I would much rather this story be the only time we ever hear about Peter's parents, that we know anything about them, and then we just move on. But unfortunately, Stan didn't close that book and lock it down hard enough at the end of this story. Still, highly enjoyable issue, and is continuing a pretty solid hot streak for Amazing Spider-Man on our list. I don't think we've really run into something that I would say is just unreadable garbage yet when it comes to Amazing Spider-Man, and in fact, continues to be some of my favorite reading every time we do this. So, though I am not a fan of that element, I got to give this book a lot of credit for being entertaining, quick read, even being a 48 pager. So good stuff on Amazing Annual number 5.
Outstanding. Tim, your thoughts here on the Amazing Spider-Man Annual number 5?
About the same. I am not thrilled with the parents being super secret agents thing. I never have been. Think it would have been enough to say that they just died in an accident and Peter was raised by his aunt and uncle.
What's the opposite of our gift for later writers? What would that be? Because, like, this is something that wasn't that bad to start with, and then other people took it and made it so much worse. Whereas a lot of the other things that are famous gifts for later writers that people would develop, you know, they would take a concept and make it better. This is the first incarnation of us seeing something that just never got any better than this, and it wasn't all that great to begin with.
Yeah, I think this is like a Russian nesting doll with a turd inside for later writers.
Yeah.
To unpack.
That's accurate.
Just really, you can't even call it diminishing returns. It just, as soon as you try to revisit this, it kind of falls apart. Something I really enjoyed about this issue, actually, in this story, Aunt May feels like a character for the first time ever.
But may I point out, though, I this came to mind while I was reading it. So we see Aunt May in the modern context, right?
Looking
old as fuck and near death, as she always does. And then we see a flashback to Peter as a baby, like wearing diapers.
And she looks old as fuck and near death.
Now, you can look at the glass half full or half empty. Half full, she hasn't aged a day in 15 or 17 years. So she got that going for her, which is nice. Glass half empty, the bitch has been on her deathbed for the better part of 20 years now.
Yes, the very Arne Andersonian Aunt May.
I was going to remark on something on that. I'm glad you brought that up because, I guess the only way this could have been even more insane is if they would have revealed that that Richard was the older brother.
Oh, wow.
that's the only way that whole thing could be any more nuts. But you'd think that they could have at least like given her a different hair color. Maybe that would have at least offset it a little and say, oh, well, okay, so she aged, 20 years worth in, 20 years. But no.
Aunt May, as we
have always known her, is close to that dusty death.
Perhaps some of that is down to the art, which doesn't exactly pop. Apparently by Larry Lieber.
Yeah.
So I speculate.
Uh-huh.
I was wondering.
Yes, it is by Larry Lieber.
Yeah.
With an assist from Romita on Faces Only.
It would have to be.
Okay, I was going to say here's what's interesting.
If you look at the Marvel Unlimited page for this book, the creators are listed as Marie Severin on pencils.
Really?
Yes. Now, in the story itself, if you open up the book and you flip to that first page where we typically have our credits, it says produced by Stan Lee and Larry Lieber, embellished by Mickey DeMeo, Artie Simak, John Romita. But again, the Marvel Unlimited page lists Marie Severin as the penciler of this issue.
And yet she's usually much better than this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, in any case, I like that Aunt May felt like a character and felt like a person, not just a pain in the ass plot device that she's been in like every story up to this point. Like, you get the sense, you understand.
She doesn't have the vapors and become bedridden.
No, she doesn't fall out at any point. The super spy angle is dumb, but now you get a better sense and understanding of, their Aunt May and Uncle Ben's devotion to Peter, this child who they've loved and cared for, since he was in diapers. And I mean, we see some of those scenes and they kind of do have that emotional connection. So because they care, it helps us care. And that just goes a long way. So yeah, beyond that, pretty cool Red Skull reveal like that. Otherwise, not a whole lot to say here.
Awesome. Todd, your thoughts here on Amazing Spider-Man Annual number 5.
Thank God for the Red Skull, because I was bored out of my head with this comic. This was the most mediocre Spider-Man story I've seen chronologically to this point. The Red Skull reveal and subsequent battle and Spider-Man being in a little over his head kind of made it a little better. It was also kind of weird to see Spider-Man in this environment as well. It didn't feel right. It didn't feel like a Spider-Man that I would expect from 1968. I didn't know it was a thing. I've never been a fan of the super spy story for the parents, neither in the Amazing Spider-Man film nor here in the comics or any incarnation of Spider-Man. So, you know, at least it's mediocre. It's not bad to me. That's the best I can say. I wish we had had some Amazing Spider-Man proper.
Right.
But this was important because of the parents' reveal. But I really don't care. And honestly, I think just at some point there are too many coincidences in these stories, you know?
Yeah,
what is
very much agree.
Peter's mom's name?
Mary.
Okay, Mary. All right.
Martha.
Damn it.
Somehow I thought it was June. But yeah, it's Mary Parker. That's right. So, yeah, I don't know. And yeah, I always crack up when it's revealed that May and Uncle Ben are much, much older than the Parker, Richard and Mary there. Somehow Richard and Ben are brothers, yes, apparently? Or yeah. Is that it?
Yeah, Ben and Richard are brothers. Richard is the younger brother. But another thing that'll maybe bug you that bugged me about this issue, because Aunt May tells Peter that they learned about Richard being a spy by reading it in the newspaper, and she hid it from Peter all those years, and yet there was never any visit from the authorities to the Parker household concerning, hey, your brother was a spy allegedly for the Nazis.
No, Russell, I just call that a gift for later writers.
Yeah. A gift that somebody should have kept the receipt for.
As but, Tim said, the Russian nesting dolls with a turd on the inside.
We get a good cover with.
The cover is good. Yeah.
Some floating heads of guilt. A parade of floating heads of guilt.
Right. Including some floating heads of guilt that don't even appear in the issue.
That's right. For no reason, you know, yes.
I'm looking at them.
Mary Parker looks just like Betty Brant.
Gwen Stacy is nowhere in this issue. J. Jonah Jameson's nowhere in this issue. Robbie Robertson.
None of the supporting cast are. Not really, other than Aunt May in a flashback.
Yeah, Aunt May in a flashback. Yeah, you're right. Good point. And Uncle Ben, I think, is in a flashback as well.
Yeah.
They said she's the only one who appears.
Yeah, Uncle Ben, too, right? Doesn't he appear in one of the flashbacks?
Yeah,
but in there, at the bottom. Smoking the pipe on the side, I guess. I assume that's him anyway.
Yeah.
Only old people smoke pipes. You guys know that.
Yeah, the guy smoking the pipe is Captain Stacy.
Captain Stacy.
Is he?
Yeah, Uncle Ben is towards the bottom, I think.
Oh, you're right. I see him now. There he is.
It's like Frederick Foswell.
It is Frederick Foswell. Betty Brant and
amazing the things
Ned
you can see on an iPad Pro.
Who's right, the cop who character?
Who are these people?
Who's the cop
Officer
character?
Officer Krupke.
Is that a serious answer, or are you just fucking with me?
No, I am. It's stereotypical Irish cop number 103.
Okay, because the other ones I recognize, but that one I'm like, I don't know. Anyway, well, with that discussion on Amazing Spider-Man.
Oh, it's Flash Thompson in the Air Force.
Oh, that's right.
Is it really?
It is.
Huh. Yeah. There you go. In any event, with that discussion on Amazing Spider-Man Annual number 5 coming to a close, we have reached the end of our reading list, and we have reached the end of 1968. So as we do at the end of every year, we're going to give out some year-end awards. So we'll start here once again with the Writer of the Year, and as we have done the last couple episodes, if anyone would like the opportunity to make a case for anyone other than Stan Lee, I open the floor to that. Otherwise, we will give it to Stan and move on. Anyone?
I will nominate Jim Steranko.
That's not a bad nomination. Okay, explain.
Well, but I don't think he's going to win. But I think just his contributions are significant enough that they are notable. Mm-hmm. It's the first writer besides Stan to kind of stand out to me.
I agree.
We got other writers, Roy Thomas, Gary Friedrich, who did a nice job. But as far as memorable comics, you got to give a nod to Steranko for what he did with Nick Fury. I'm still going to give the nod to Stan for my writer of the year, but I believe we need to consider Steranko too.
I would agree with that. I think it's the first time in the course of this project we really had reason to consider anyone other than Stan. But for me personally, the combination of Fantastic Four, which we read in our first episode on 1968, with Silver Surfer here today and his other contributions across the Marvel landscape, it tilts the scales in favor of Stan for me. So I'll go Stan Lee once again as my writer of the year. Anyone else want to weigh in on that?
I absolutely do think he needs to be nominated, yes. But I don't think you can really separate his writing from his art. If the category is writer of the year, then can't really give it to him. But he definitely deserves a look. But Stan still got this one locked up for me.
At least it's notable that he's the first person that we've even been like, okay, hold on a second. You know, because for the first few years, nobody other than Stan wrote anything on our list. And now, he is slowly starting to cede control of scripting, he's still keeping enough control over, you know, predominantly Fantastic Four, but writing enough other things that he continues to be the dominant force to me.
And who saw that coming? You figured that would be like a Roy Thomas or someone, not Steranko, as a notable contender, first contender to Stan Lee.
Well, he's in, then he's out. Russell?
Yeah. If it hadn't been for Silver Surfer, Jim Steranko would have won my Writer of the Year.
Right.
Whoa.
If it had not been for Silver Surfer. But Silver Surfer comes along and completely put Stan over the top. Like, Stan's contributions were great, yes, but there were also plenty of stuff I could look at and say, maybe this wasn't so good. And then along comes, like you pointed out correctly, the Fantastic Four stuff that we read in part one. That was all very good. And then we get Silver Surfer here in the back half, and that is just some tremendous work. And Steranko only has these three issues of Nick Fury, one of which is a little Scooby-Doo weird. Stan Lee has got this locked up on the strength of FF and Silver Surfer, but Steranko, he's getting, like you guys pointed out, he's kind of opened up that door of maybe there is room for a different writer to come in and be that new it guy. And I think we're on the cusp of seeing that happen.
Yeah. In terms of our 1968 list, Stan is still writing at this point Thor, Fantastic Four, Silver Surfer, and Spider-Man. So still writing enough to keep.
I forgot to point out Thor. Yeah, the Thor issues were good.
Right. Keeping a pretty firm stranglehold, I think, on that writer of the year thing. But you guys are right. He's been ceding control over the last few years, as we've seen. And now with Steranko, there's some quality there. You know, whereas other years, he let other people write. But let's be honest, it wasn't that. It was fine, but nothing
more than
fine. It
still hasn't been that good.
Right. This is the first thing that was legitimately good and not written by Stan. But in any event, clean sweep, Stan Lee is the writer of the year for 1968. Artist of the year. And this falls, for me, into a little bit of the same category of it's quality versus quantity. Because Jack Kirby did a lot of good work. If you look at 1968, you look at Fantastic Four, you look at Thor, a lot of stuff to love there from Jack Kirby. There's a strong argument to be made, I feel, for Jack Kirby in 1968 just because of the breadth of his output. But I'm going to go the way I think the rest of the panel will also go. Nothing that we have seen to this point in this Marvel Age project has been anything like what Jim Steranko did in those first three issues of Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. Mind-blowing. Words escape me. As Tim said, how do you do justice to this in an audio medium when it's such a visual masterpiece? For me, Jim Steranko is the artist of the year for 1968. Tim, what about you?
Yeah, hands down, Steranko. There's certainly some excellent, excellent Kirby work that we saw. Not so much in the second half of 68. We actually didn't read any Kirby in the second part of 68. But for as great as he is, I don't think he did anything that we haven't seen before from Kirby. Sounds like damning with faint praise, but Steranko is just such a game changer. You have to give it to him.
Agreed. Todd?
I pick Steranko as well, though I do also want to mention John Buscema because his art was maybe the only good thing about Avengers, mm-hmm. and he did a great job on Silver Surfer. Yeah. Despite, you know, that first issue being super Kirby influenced, the issue number 3 is on its own just a masterwork as well. So Buscema definitely worthy of praise and becomes Marvel's kind of house guy. I literally wrote the book. I say that every time. But come on, Steranko changed the whole game. And I'm still just blown away by what we saw in those comics. Reading it both page to page and then panel to panel on tablet is really a neat way to check it out too, or really a unique way to read those comics.
Interesting
storytelling, innovative, realistic art and yet futuristic art. Like the way he did the tech. I like the way he does faces and expressions, and it's just was pop art of a different level. So Steranko.
Nice. Russell.
Let's clean sweep it. Mm-hmm. Jim Steranko is the clear choice here on everything that's already been said. The guy came in and changed the way that we look at comics, and really just in one issue, but he gave us 3 all-timer classics right back to back to back. So that's it. You just have to see this to really get a good understanding of what it is we're talking about. Hard to describe it fully in this medium, in an audio medium, but still, what a work this guy turned in and should be seen by anyone who calls themselves a comics fan.
Absolutely. Moving on to a category we just introduced last episode, or last year, I believe, one that was brought up at the behest of one Todd Weber. Let's go to cover of the year, and I'll give you guys I'll stall for you a moment so you can flip through covers in case you weren't prepared. And for me, despite the fact that Tim and I questioned a little bit of the quality of the actual story being told, to me, I look to Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. number 3, and the cover for that issue where we have this kind of like gothic castle in the backdrop with a full moon behind it, and you have this shadowy Hound of the Baskervilles leaping forward, and in the shadows, up in the clouds of the night, you have the outline of the face of Nick Fury looking down. It's really a breathtaking cover. Kind of looks more like something you would see on a Tales of the Crypt from EC Comics or something of that nature. Very different than just about any other cover we've seen to this point, really leaning into those horror vibes. So for me, I'm going to go Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. number 3 as our cover of the year. Todd, what about you?
Pass.
Still looking.
Tim, make a snap judgment. Ooh, here.
Man, I'm going to go Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. number 1.
That was my other contender. I'm glad you brought it up, though. Go ahead.
Just so psychedelic, so mind-warping just to look at and to try to take in and process what's going on here. And again, I don't even want to even attempt to describe it in audio. You just have to see it.
That one especially, you can't really describe it. It's got some cubes and they're all doing different things, and like that doesn't make any sense if I try to describe it. When you see it, you're like,
right.
Oh, I get it. That's so the story. Just, yeah.
It's so conceptual, but looks amazing.
It
so
really does.
That's what I'm going to give it to.
I'm glad you called it out. Like I said, that was my close runner up. Russell, your cover of the year for 1968.
I am real close on this one because there are 2 that I absolutely loved, and I'll get to my winner in a second, but my runner-up has got to be Amazing Spider-Man Annual number 5.
That's a good one.
That genre, that John Romita cover is just tremendously well done. I love all the detail in this, and I'm just a big fan of Romita's rendering of Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. So this, as Tim was pointing out about the psychedelic nature of Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. number one, I feel like Amazing Spider-Man Annual has a lot of those same qualities. So
yeah, kind of like this vortex effect going on.
Yeah, it's a really cool effect. It's one that has a lot of subtle detail in it if you blow it up and look at it really closely. So yeah, testament to John Romita as an artist, but Nick, you called it Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. number 3 is absolutely the best cover that we saw this year's reading list. It is absolutely a testament to the power of Steranko's ability. He nails it on this cover, and this is a cover I think that has probably influenced a lot of other comic artists who've come up. So you can't deny the power of this. I think it's pretty easy to win. Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. number 3, cover of the year.
Todd, we're gonna come back around to you.
Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. number 1.
Okay,
right. Unique enough, and I combines kind of the 60s elements of psychedelica with the unique espionage stuff that was going on in this book. Mm-hmm. And love the way he drew the villain. I seem to recall the Vision comic cover being really good too.
Yeah.
But I'm looking for it, and I don't think we read that, did we?
We did not
this year.
I suppose
we read 49, which is the Magneto cover, which wasn't as good.
Yeah, you could nominate something off the reading list, but I you know, that's up to you.
Okay, then I nominate Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. number 4.
Yeah.
All right, fair enough, but, you know. If in lieu of that, you're going with number 1.
Number 1.
Yeah.
Number 1. It's a tie.
Good call. Moving on to our hero of the year. This one's a little bit more interesting. And I'm going to go – I did not see this one coming into the year.
Hang on.
Yes.
Talking about Avengers 57 is the Vision cover, which we did read.
We did read it.
And that is very good. And I'm second guessing myself. No, I'm sticking with Steranko.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now because Todd called it out, but I'm also going to stick with my Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. number 3.
Man. Yeah. That's a great cover, though. We can't sleep on that Avengers cover.
Come a Vision or behold a Vision.
Behold the Vision. Anyway, moving on to our Hero of the Year. And as I said, I did not see this one coming into the year. I would have never thought I would have given it to this character. But I have to go with the Silver Surfer as the hero of 1968. Those first three issues, just so different from anything else that Stan has written. Just very... I don't even know the word. Just very different from Stan's usual voice. Telling a bit of a misanthropic tale, telling a story about a character who, if he decided to just wipe us all off the face of the planet, he'd be somewhat justified in doing so, and yet he doesn't. And that's kind of the appeal of the character here, and it's explored to expert effect in the pages of these first three issues. So for me, Norrin Radd, the Silver Surfer, is my character of the year. Tim, what about you?
Yep, same for me. Love the Surfer just from the jump. He's that gentle philosopher with the nobility at heart and that great, just perfect commentary on the human condition. Even though comics were not political until 2017.
Right.
This is just wow. Stan nails it with this character.
Yep.
And I think hands down we've got to give it to the Surfer here.
I would agree. Todd, your hero of the year for 1968.
From the pages of the Amazing Spider-Man Annual, there was this little backup feature called Here We Go Applauding, featuring Stan Lee, Larry Lieber eating a bowl full of sour balls, and Jazzy's Johnny Romita. I don't know who wrote it. There are no credits on this story. There's this one panel appearance of Roy Thomas dressed in the most ridiculous outfit. So I'm giving it to Roy Thomas here. No, my choice is the Silver Surfer.
There you go.
Because he is the most sympathetic hero, I think, and the most admirable hero that we witnessed the exploits of this year, 1968, throughout the line, without seeing perhaps Spider-Man's exploits in his own book. We only saw the kind of expository issue of the annual. I think Silver Surfer is kind of the hero of this year that stands apart from the crowd.
I would agree, of course. Russell, your hero of the year.
Let's call it another clean sweep. The Silver Surfer takes it.
Haven't had one of these in a while, a virtual clean sweep across the board.
This rarely happens.
It was an easy pick after reading those first three issues. For all the things that you guys have already pointed out, he is so different from everything we're reading. I mean, well, I know we classify him as a superhero, but he doesn't even feel like that to me. It just feels like a nobility type character who's, you know, started out wanting to explore and to maybe make a better universe, but he doesn't really view himself so much as a superhero as he does like more of a philosopher, one who's trying to show people a better way. And in my view, this was as great an introduction to a character as we've ever had. So, yeah, Silver Surfer, Hero of the Year.
Awesome.
He feels like a refugee that we treat like shit.
Okay, right.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
I'll stop.
Go ahead. No, please, continue.
No, continue.
I'm the host of this here outfit, and I say you continue.
I just think it's funny you mentioned like how he would almost be justified in wiping us all out, and it's just so funny the way that Stanley writes this. We talked about how it's very unlike him, and he just makes a really good case for Giant Bomb in the way that the Surfer interacts with humanity. And it was like he met the one good person that actually did treat him with kindness to set him off on the right foot in like Alicia Masters. Mm-hmm. And then ever since then, he's like, what is with this planet? What is wrong with these people? Like, how can I be condemned to this existence? this is intolerable.
On a related note, if you haven't seen the trailer for that movie Brightburn, I really fucking want to see it. But that's neither here nor there. Moving on to our villain of the year. This one's interesting because virtually every other year we have had villains who have popped up multiple times on our reading list. You don't really have that here. You could go a number of different directions. I am torn between two primarily, and it's really, really close, and I'm going to give it by the slightest of margins to Galactus based on this. His appearance in Fantastic Four 77, and then the full reveal of his interactions with the planet of Xin-La in that Silver Surfer origin in Silver Surfer number 1, just a reminder of how great that character can be. Close between he and my runner-up. I'm hoping one of you will call out my runner-up here in a moment, but I'm going to give it to Galactus. Russell, your villain of the year for 1968.
Again, this is a tough one because we don't really have, you know, the kind of like pronounced villains like we have in the past, as you pointed out. I think I got to give it to a real dark horse candidate, though. One that I'm not sure anybody else is going to pick out, but it's humanity.
Good call. I didn't consider that. That's a good call.
From the pages of Silver Surfer, because
this is rather Greg Phillipsian of you.
This is my misanthropic side coming out.
Marvel bullpen.
Humanity proves itself unworthy of Silver Surfer's attempts to help them out at every turn. So, humanity, congratulations. You are the villain of the year for this. I'm just fucking kidding with you. This is sorry guys, but that's That was one I seriously considered because they humans are terrible to Silver Surfer throughout his whole dealings. But I think Nick called it right. The Galactus really is the only truly pronounced like dyed-in-the-wool villain that we get, despite you know a great turn from Scorpio and Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. number one. Mm-hmm. That doesn't really hang on so much, and then we quickly move on to other like one and done villains. But yeah, I'm down for Galactus kind of winning this one if we have to put a named villain out there. Otherwise, I would say the humans featured in Silver Surfer.
That's a good call on both fronts, but I love the love that you're going with Galactus as well. Todd, give us your villain of the year for 1968.
I thought about it. Galactus certainly ranked. I looked kind of at the Wrecker and the Destroyer from Thor.
Destroyer, I can get behind. I cannot get behind raising the Wrecker in virtually any respect, even though I'm a massive Thor mark.
Looked at it.
Looked at him.
His name was on a list of
Franklin,
30.
Future villain Franklin Richards almost made the list. Baby Franklin.
Oh,
but I'm going to give the villain of the year to the devil himself, Mephisto.
Yes, that was my runner up, and I'm glad somebody else called it out. Go ahead.
He has souls writhing in pools beneath his feet. He wants to eradicate marriages. And keep characters from progressing.
Oh, God.
And procreating.
Ah! And
babies.
Sorry, that was my 10 years of not reading Spider-Man.
But he'll give you your secret identity back as a deal. God. So.
And your agent. And...
That's right. She's alive again. She was almost my dark horse pick for the villain.
Aunt May?
Yeah. She kept that story
alive for quite many
years. Like she pretended to be this Phoebe for forever, and then she breaks it down this very well detailed story.
But then again,
has she ever spoken more than two complete sentences?
But then again,
or passing out.
20 years to Aunt May is really like the blink of an eye. Like it just it means nothing to her in her grand scheme of things.
I tell you what, when you get to be my age, it's the same truth, brother.
All right, so Mephisto, good to hear. That was my close runner up. So I'm glad to hear somebody else gave him some love. That was an outstanding turn from him in Silver Surfer number three. Honestly, that's the best Mephisto thing I've ever read. I've read a little bit of his interactions with Ghost Rider. I have conversed with One More Day, and that's the less said about that, the better. Tim,
good in the Infinity Gauntlet.
There you go. Tim, your villain of the year for 1968.
Yeah, this was, I mean, I didn't even consider anyone but Mephisto,
okay.
The devil himself. Kind of surprised anyone else. Anyway, I'm not coming for you or anything. It's just, even if he wasn't the literal devil, I thought this was a really good introduction to this character.
Right.
And I love the way that, it's just this tremendous romantic concept that the laws of reality will just bend to his every whim to achieve anything, but only when he has a willing subject. And it just frustrates him to no end that he cannot tempt this purity of spirit that is the Silver Surfer. Try as he might, he converts him into pure thought and absorbs him to corrupt him, but it actually works the other way around in that great scene. I love what the material that we got out of that. And I want to see more from this pairing. I'm kind of shipping them, if you couldn't tell.
Apparently he pops up later in Silver Surfer, but that's not on our reading list.
Oh yes.
He
pops up quite a bit in Silver Surfer, I believe.
Yeah, but maybe he'll also pop up in Thor in future years, so hopefully we will encounter him at some point.
Which kind of paints Silver Surfer as a Christ-like slash...
It does.
Not just a Hamlet-type figure, but a savior, messiah.
Mm-hmm. Got that a lot.
Yep. All right. And we're going to wrap it up, of course, with our story of the year. Our overall story of the year. For me, I look at it, and it's very close between two things. And I'm going to take it literally. And when I say story of the year, I am looking at the actual tale that is being told. If I was strictly evaluating it based on visuals, it would be Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. and a runaway. But I'm going to give the nod to Silver Surfer, 1-3. Those first three issues and kind of Stan Lee's exploration of the state of humanity. The most shockingly good thing we have read for this project. I have had a baseline of expectations for everything that we have read coming in, and nothing has completely subverted those expectations and blown them out of the water the way these first three issues of Silver Surfer did. So for me, Silver Surfer 1-3 is far and away the story of the year. What about, let's see, let's go to Tim, you first here.
Okay, I'm glad you went to me because I am going to do the exact same thing you did with the exact same result. I'm being very much a literalist for this category. And yeah, as far as a story, it is Silver Surfer 1-3 for me. The only other thing in contention would be the Steranko Fury material. But those are kind of three really mind-blowing individual issues, right, as opposed to, like, the story is not the story when it comes to those comics.
Right.
It just isn't really. And that's to take nothing away from them, but
they're outstanding.
Not an appropriate answer for me for this category. So there you have it.
All right, Russell, your story of the year.
I don't think there's really any arguing against it. Silver Surfer 1-3. It is just all there. Everything that we love about good storytelling in these early days of comics or early days of superhero comics is right there. It is just a great character, beautifully done art, though maybe not the best art that we see out of all of these issues we read for 68. But still, really well done stuff. A social commentary from Stan that really gets deep into the philosophical side of how he views the world, and a dare I say it, compelling as hell lead character. So, Silver Surfer, it's a 3-3 on all of these issues, despite them being like double size. That's actually a feature, not a bug.
Right.
In these issues.
Which is rare for these early Marvel stuff because, I mean, like, the annuals have kind of been hit or miss. And for the ones that hit, they're great. But that expanded page count has really been an albatross for those that don't. And, like you said, it's a feature here.
Yeah, it is a feature. And I was real close. If it had been... I'm going to say this. If it hadn't been for that just weird as hell third issue of Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., that could have walked away with the title for me. But that third issue is what torpedoed the win for Steranko's Nick Fury. And then Silver Surfer stepped up with three straight-ahead great comics, even. I'll go ahead and say it. They're great comics. So, easy winner.
Gotcha. Todd, your story of the year for 1968.
Yet another clean sweep.
Holy crap.
Wow.
Silver Surfer 1-3, beginning, middle, end, character development, recap, origin, dynamic action, tremendous dialogue and characterization. Introduction of new characters and compelling storylines. Brief heel turn for Silver Surfer, but it was for our own good. I just think these are kind of the revelation of the year for me for 68. And that's all I have to say.
Yeah, so this is interesting. I think we all went with the same writer, the same artist, the same hero. We were split and the same story. We were split on cover and villain, but even there, we were split two and two. So, like, not that big of a split here. And it's interesting, literally all of it comes from this episode that we just discussed. The first half of our reading list, because it was a lot of Avengers, kind of gargled my own balls, but that's neither here nor there. So with that, all that being said, that brings a close to this episode of Marvel Age. Be sure to tune in next time as we jump ahead to 1969 and to go ahead and give you a little preview of what we'll be covering in case you want to read along. We're going to be reading Thor 160 through 162, as well as 168 through 169. We're going to be reading Amazing Spider-Man 68 and 69, Marvel Superheroes 18, and Incredible Hulk 115 through 117, and annual number one of that series. So before we let you go, we will close, as we always do, and give the various members of the panel an opportunity to pitch what you got going on here on Place to Be Nation and Place to Be Nation Pop, and where people can interact with you on the social media. We will start with the manager himself, Mr. Todd Weber.
You can find me at Todd Weber Guitar on Twitter. I currently have no other podcasts that I am appearing on other than Marvel Age on a regular basis, but you never know when I will turn up on one. And I am proud to be the manager of the longest-running weekly comic book podcast.
Episodic.
All of Place to Be
episodic.
Nation.
Damn
it, I forgot episodic. Listen, I'm going to edit that out.
Michael Cole has been teaching us for years. You have to include episodic when you're doing that bit. But hey, I think probably not by the time this one is out, but people can in the coming weeks hear you over on the Hard Traveling Fanboy airwaves, as you and myself and Greg Phillips are going to get together to discuss a little Aquaman during Aquamonth, as in honor of the King of Atlantis's big screen debut. We are going to be talking all things Aquaman throughout the entire month of December. So as Todd alluded to, I, of course, am Nick Duke. I am one half of the Hard Traveling Fanboys, the longest running yada, 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 and all that. And you can find me at NickDuke87 on the Twitter machine. I am, of course, a member of the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook group, so you can interact with me there as well. Although when I say interact with, I can say you will say things and I will likely ignore you because I generally abhor interacting with people on social media in a public setting. Tim, what else you got going on?
Kind of busy month for me podcast-wise. My other regular podcast gig, Talkin' Pop, with the always excellent Jennifer Smith. We had a very revealing interview with Nick, your co-host.
There's going to have to be a rebuttal sequel to this at some point.
Because so I'm told.
There's a lot of things that were wrong. Not flat out, not like misrememberings or we can differ on the details. There's just a lot of shit there that was factually inaccurate, and I blame it on his aged brain. See, the problem is here that Greg's brain has not been preserved by alcohol the way mine has. And so it's not got a pristine memory the way I do. That's the issue here.
So you're saying the Koresh thing was a mess? Was not?
Wait, what?
You have a rebuttal for what Greg said, so it's about 9/11 and the Koresh thing?
No, in regards to other things on the podcast.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm confused.
Very interesting. Great way to tease out the what you can hear about and more on that episode of Talking Pop with Greg Phillips.
Don't fucking judge me.
No, I'm not judging at all. I think you did a good service to the community. Okay, and on Jenny's other show, Freak Out Drive-In, I actually joined her to watch a weird slasher movie called Blood Rage. So we did a live watch. Check that out as well. most recently, Andy Atherton had a new podcast and his expanding suite of podcasts.
Just one?
Well, this was designed as a pod blast. I think it ended up being more of a cast. Breaking down the trailers recently released for Captain Marvel and the first Avengers Endgame. What's so funny?
It just struck me, the irony of you doing an in-depth dive on the Avengers Endgame trailer.
Avengers. I hated it so much, like, I want to see the next one.
Not to give you a preview of the next issue of our next episode of Hard Traveling Fanboys, let me say, even as someone who was super impressed by Infinity War and is all in on where they're going, even I to that trailer went, all right, I am no more excited to see a movie than I was previously.
Yeah. Kind of by design, I think.
It was intentional, but like, so I'm interested to hear your thoughts as someone who comes from no interest at a basement floor of interest compared to my attic of interest.
Yeah, it's not so much lack of interest as it was. Let's try to move on from Infinity War now and right some wrongs, perhaps. Anyway. What the hell am I talking about?
Survey says.
Yes, on Place to Be Nation Wrestling. So Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed. We'll have another episode of Survey Says. I don't know when in the days ahead, we'll say. It's not in my hands anymore, which is good. It just needs to go out. And so you can look for that, I'm sure, very, very soon. We've also got coming up the Place to Be Nation annual Christmas play that we will all have some involvement in.
We sure will.
We sure will. So that'll be going down, in advance of your holiday festivities. So look for that in the weeks ahead.
Absolutely.
And on Twitter, you can find me at Cyke68, CYKE68.
There you are. Russell, plug your shit.
I have some shit to plug.
There you go.
I have the DC Post-Crisis Management Podcast. The road trip continues. I have recently attempted to stop in and beautiful Las Vegas, Nevada, to talk with one Ben Morse about Infinite Crisis. And I will say that he is the first of you to actually have adequate security around his home. So the getting in process was a bit more perilous. So you'll have to listen to find out just exactly what I had to go through to get inside his house.
Please tell me there are more stops on the road following Infinite Crisis than what I fear is coming up next?
There probably are not. No.
Oh, God.
Nope. I will. But Infinite Crisis will be hitting pretty soon. A little bit more to go on that, and then you guys should be getting that hopefully by the end of this month. And then I will be teasing out what comes after that. At a later date.
Will you be counting down what's coming next?
Possibly. That might be
offended head shake of the red-nosed, incestuous, pig-nosed twins. Oh, fucking hell.
Can you confirm or deny whether it will be doo-doo shit?
I can confirm it's fucking doo-doo shit.
Hey, Boss Darkseid likes it just fine.
At least part of that episode will likely be doo-doo shit. But there's a surprise coming for my upcoming co-host for that one that I think might lift his spirits just a ever so slightly. But anyway, I've also got another show coming up later this month. It's currently in the editing process. I can go ahead and announce that 90 to Nothing. The retrospective of 1990s movies will be hitting the Place to Be Nation pop airwaves along with my co-host and longtime personal friend, Sam Neely. We'll be debuting near the end of this month as we take a look at the 1990 Christmas classic, Home Alone. So,
oh, you're going to say Die Hard, but that's not a 90s movie.
No, Die Hard was released in 1988. Home Alone was released in 1990.
I was only 30.
So. Okay.
Die Hard and Scrooge, two Christmas classics, came out in the same year.
Yes. Yeah. And
when did Lethal Weapon come out?
87.
It was 87 for that one. But we decided to kick off with the holidays. Hope everybody will tune into that one and get some enjoyment out of it. We had a great time recording it, so you guys will have to be on the lookout for that one. And, of course, catch me here on the Marvel Age and occasionally on Marvel Age Masterclass. And beyond that, you can find me on the Twitter machine, Russell_Sellers, as well as the Facebook Place to Be Nation Comics group. I'll be plugging my shit in there as well and interacting with folks who want to talk comics. So come on by. It's a good time. And, you never know where I might pop up. I've been invited to various other podcasts along the way. And, I also happen to just crash into people's houses and turn off all their lights. So that's just my gimmick. And the less security they have, the easier it is. But anyway, I might be crashing with a certain bulldog in the very near future. So
you bring that Grant Morrison shit in my house, I'm gonna slap you upside the face with 3 inches of limp dick.
Someone's being generous to himself today.
Man.
Anyway,
that's a bear in a fur coat.
Yeah, you had to find it first. Anyway, we shall see what comes up in the near future. But anyway, that's where you can find me.
Absolutely. And also, one thing we failed to mention, you can hear each and every member of this here podcast on a recent giant-sized edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys that was released.
Triggered.
We, of course, recently dropped the third biennial Place to Be Nation Pop Peter David Memorial Fantasy Comics Draft Pitches, presented by a hypothetical non-rotational DC Comics online unlimited subscription service. Certainly a unique situation that played out over the course of about 2.5 hours, including concession speeches that must be heard to be believed from all members of the panel, in addition to a victory speech that must be heard to be believed from one member of the
panel. Is the victor among us? That remains to be seen. Check out that podcast.
No, I will provide no spoilers here.
We're
I am
all winners, Tim.
I am no
We're
Trent Williams. I provide no spoilers right here. But in any event, we thank you all for joining us. We hope you have enjoyed this trip through 1968 in Marvel Comics. We look forward to you joining us for our trip into 1969. So with all that being said, thank you for joining us. We hope you have a wonderful evening. Enough said.